From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last fall in Detroit, Michigan. Two women, two longtime friends, were having dinner together in one of their homes, and their discussion turned to politics. Things got heated. One woman sided with Republicans, one sided with the Democrats. They argued about the presidential candidates, and there are conflicting accounts of exactly what happened next. But attorneys agree that Tawana Sullivan, 51 years old, grabbed the crock pot off the stove and she began bludgeoning her friend, 66-year-old Cheryl Livy. By the time police arrived, Livy was lying on the floor unconscious with a slow cooker's cord around her neck, and she died soon thereafter. This awful story is the extreme example, obviously, of what can happen when our emotions about politics overcome our ability to make rational decisions. But it's probably fair to say that while most of us won't end up in violent confrontations, we've been in situations with family or friends or coworkers that at least get uncomfortable. And it begs the question, when should we talk about politics? When should we turn it off? If your friend or family member or coworker asks you to stop talking politics, should you honor that request? And maybe it begs another question, too. Shouldn't we be able to disagree without becoming so angry? Our guest this hour will explore these questions with us, and let me welcome them now. Jesse Sleaser is here. Jesse's communications and district director for State Senator Rich Funke. Jesse, nice to have you back here.
Thanks for having me, Evan. Great to be here.
Bill Maley is the supervisor of the town of Brighton. Bill, welcome back.
Thanks, Evan. Great to be here as always.
And Eric Kane is the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Eric, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, the two people at this table who work in politics probably have had to learn how to speak. And actually, I'll be honest. I mean, Jesse and Bill were invited because you guys are both at the top of the list of people who I love talking politics with. I feel like you are both sharp as tacks, but not bomb-throwing. And I think, I hope that that makes sense to people. But Jesse, I'll start with you. I mean, you have to talk politics in your job.
Yeah.
What about in your personal life? Do people tell you, I know you're in politics, I don't want to talk about it, or do they assume that you're going to talk about it?
I think it varies by the interaction in a lot of ways. I'll say generally, and I don't want to say that I'm going to speak as a block for people like me who work in politics. I don't think I could do that. But
and you're not speaking for all Republicans or even for Rich Funke. You're speaking for yourself.
Just for myself.
Yes.
But I think my general tact, and I think there'll be disagreement at the table, is that I try to the extent that I can, steer my conversations in private with family, with friends, away from politics. I don't actively seek out those engagements. That's a very different thing than I think, though, than running from the conversation. Because I think when I have, you can tell typically in an interaction with someone whether they're interested in that sort of thing. And they may approach you and say, hey, I know the line of work you're in. I'm very interested in these issues or this race or these candidates. And at that point, the door has sort of been open for that conversation to start. Very rarely would I wear that on my sleeve to the point where that's the introductory part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times it's a feeling out that goes on during the first phase, especially with extended family, with folks who you know well, but not incredibly well. But that being said, I think, you know, I'm a little bit of a unique case study in that I met my wife through this line of work. And we now have two little boys at home. And so a lot of my life is based on my experience in politics. You know, we were both working in the same line of work. We had very similar passions. So that doesn't mean we agree all the time. I think Aaron would tell you that. But the nexus of personal and political is very clear to me. I think this year, and I'm sure we'll talk more about it, it's become more difficult than ever. And I don't have the extensive knowledge going back, you know, multiple cycles like a lot of folks do. But I will tell you that not only does it seem to me to be more charged this year than it has in some recent cycles, but additionally, it's not just Republican on Democrat anymore. I mean, you get a lot of very passionate disagreements, Democrats disagreeing, Republicans disagreeing, yeah. And then you have the whole swath of America out there who doesn't really align themselves with either party. So it can be tricky.
Okay. Bill Maley, what do you think?
Well, I certainly agree with a lot of what Jesse said. I mean, my job, although politics is certainly involved, it's how, you know, those of us that are elected officials are elected. My job is really a government job. So 9 to 5 working in town hall, I'm focused on government. And very, very rarely, if at all, are we talking politics. And you and I talked a little bit beforehand in general how the workplace can be a very different scenario than over the back fence. I mean, in a workplace, those of us that are employers legitimately do have to worry about we don't want our employees to be in an environment, a working environment, where they're feeling as though they're harassed, where they're being forced to listen to someone haranguing them about political issues that, frankly, they just want to do their work. They don't want to be a part of. But so from that perspective, you know, a lot of my time is spent in a government setting. But sure, the conversation does come up. And as I was thinking about today, it's not just about the presidential election. And sometimes it does get involved in government. We've been talking a lot in Brighton these past couple months about a development project. People have very strong feelings, both pro and con, about that potential development project. And people stop me and talk to me about it on the street or at the farmer's market or wherever all the time. But we also had a public hearing. We had 49 people talking about that project. And every last one of them, they were civil. They came up, they spoke their mind. And I really appreciated that, because it is an indication that people can come together for something that they feel very strongly about and speak civilly, and that's something we should all aspire to.
Well, as I turn to Eric Kane, who's the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center, let me read some Pew Research data just out today. This is from Pew today. Only 25% of registered voters who favor Trump respond that they have at least a few friends backing Clinton. Only 18% of Clinton supporters say they have at least a few friends who will vote for Donald Trump. Among Clinton supporters, nearly half of those surveyed, 47%, said they do not have any friends who are voting for Trump. And about 1 in 3, 31% of those leaning Trump said the same about Clinton supporters. They don't know any Clinton supporters. Overall, 37% of all voters said they have had an argument about this election. 62% have said they have not. Who are those 62%? And so
they've closed the doors and hidden, yeah. Pulled down the shades.
So before I ask you to address some of that, Eric, I want to listen to what late night comedian Seth Meyers said about this point recently. He clearly does not favor Trump, but he was targeting the Democrats out there saying, "Oh, come on, Trump can't win." And Seth Meyers was riffing on this very idea of how clustered we are. This is Seth Meyers.
But I know what you're going to say. I don't know anyone who's planning to vote for Trump. Oh, you don't? Did you ask everybody in your yoga class? Did you check with the entire drum circle? Because guess what? You know you have that crazy uncle you only see at Thanksgiving? Well, this country is about 48% crazy uncles. And it's about to be Thanksgiving all day, every day.
So there's Myers, and the data is showing that he's making a good point there. What I'm wondering, Eric, is, first of all, I'd like you to react to what you're seeing from Pew in this research and tell us, is this especially acute right now, or have we always sort of been self-segregated?
Well, you know, I'm going to take this from several vantage points. Yeah. Since I'm older than anyone else in the room here, you know, I certainly remember going forward the 1960 election. You know, that was the first time there were political debates. There was a lot of trepidation about what those would be like, and we've had those ever since. And there's been a sense of respect and a sense of understanding that there's a common process. Bill talked about public hearing. Well, it's an institutionalized public process. But, you know, politics are personal. They're about beliefs and values, and, you know, they run in your blood. You know, I'm sure you're raising a couple of kids, and we can bet what their political views are going to be soon. It's very hard to separate the political from the personal when people sit down, especially in unstructured situations. But if we think about our politics, you know, and this is not so much psychiatry, but history over the last 25 years, they become more and more polarized. I mean, we can think about Newt Gingrich on the Republican side, or Robert Bork in the hearings and the Democrats. And certainly we understand that over the last 20, 25 years, we've seen a whole series of things, whether it's how the Clintons were dealt with in the 90s or how George W. Bush was dealt with in the aughts, and or Obama now. And it's a different feel from the 1950s and even the 1960s, although clearly in the 1960s we had polarization, but it would be, for instance, the Democrats often beating on the Democrats, in some ways reminiscent of what we've seen this year. So there's a sense of unfettered criticism. And I think some of that's different. There is a quality of belittling that we see that's different. And so the respect part seems to be changing.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned belittling. I mean, if you watched Barack Obama's speech at the convention, there are times where he was almost giggling at the idea of Trump. It's really hard for him to hold it back because he clearly just doesn't respect the man.
Right.
And I think if he were talking to you privately, he would say, I've got to hold it together because I just don't get it. I'm not sure that's a good look for undecideds or people who are voting for Trump, but it certainly plays to what you're talking
right.
about.
And I think for those of us in the post-World War II era, this emergence is novel, whether it's over the last 20 years or this particular election. And of course, if we go back to the 1800s and maybe from the second election onward until the Civil War, and it's really, I mean, we think about the politics before the Civil War, you know, for someone to stand up on the Senate floor and hit another person with a cane was the kind of thing which we understood. Not that we accepted, but the idea of assault and battery as part of the political process was not unusual, and the idea of defaming people in the most blatant sort of fashion. I think that we hoped, you know, that we have a civil society, a respectful society. The idea of someone standing up on the floor when the president is giving the State of the Union address and calling him a liar, whatever your political stripes, was shocking to a lot of us, because it's not just the individual, it's the office, mm-hmm. the institution again. And so I think one of the other things that we're seeing is right now there seems to be a breakdown of what we would call both the traditional and institutional safeguards that we've so much depended on, and the question of how we're going to build them again, even as it is, even as politics are personal.
Let me read an email from a listener named Anna, because I mentioned the president kind of laughing about the idea of Donald Trump. But I got to say, just over a year ago, Jesse Slezer was part of a panel here, and not a whole lot of the Republicans on the panel were taking seriously the idea of Trump. And a year ago, obviously here we are. Let me go ahead and read this email from a listener named Anna. Evan, I can't help but feel that Donald Trump has made things even more heated and divided than usual, and I'll give you an example. Anna says, every year on the 4th of July, my family gets together. We have good-natured arguments about politics. We tend to laugh, have a few drinks, no big deal. But some members of my family just cannot understand how anyone would vote for Trump. And this year it got nasty. People left the party. Does your panel think this year is unique because of him? Jesse, what do you think of Anna's comment?
I think the observations are right, although the takeaway, the question, may not be spot on. So I would suggest that it's not a Trump-driven phenomenon in a way that it might be the nexus of the candidates that's driving this in a way. Because if you look at the polling, it's not just the GOP front-runner that is...
No, we have historic negatives on both sides.
Historically unpopular for both candidates. And I think that unpopularity tends to drive, you know, some reactions to the candidates that are more negative in ways that would not have been true in the past. And, you know, I think it was very interesting listening to a competing station this morning. Jeff DeVeronica from the newspaper and Soccer Sam Fantuzzo were on hosting a show. And Soccer Sam said something very wise, and I thought it was interesting, that this cycle is fascinating because you could have, you name a community in our area, you have houses on the same street, neighbors are exactly alike, same house, same car, similar jobs, similar families, similar lifestyles, and yet they might disagree vehemently on what they observe to be the facts at play in this election and their preferred candidates. And that's kind of an interesting thing. But I don't think you can put that on one candidate. And the other thing I would say, too, is that I do think there's an aspect to this where I'm not a media expert, but certainly I consume a lot of media every day. And I think one of the things that's not helping this situation any is that you can now go out and you can shop a media outlet with a perspective that is custom built for what you believe.
Confirmation bias.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And when you are, you know, engaged in the process of consuming facts and information and views that reflect what you already know, that's going to be a very different thing to get a flavor, to get a perspective that's different than your own. And I think what a lot of people are seeing right now is they're talking to people who think similar to them. They're consuming media that's similar to what they believe.
Yeah.
And it's hard to see anything else. Yeah.
Where I might disagree with Jesse is this. For those of us who watch the Republican debates, I think that Mr. Trump actually was different from his peers. He was willing to label people, use catchy name calling, and that was different. That was qualitatively different than other Republican candidates in the past. And on the Democratic side, although, you know, it was clear that the divide got bigger and more bitter over time, there was a restraint on how you labeled your opponent, at least not in email. We won't go to the Democrats.
There is something bizarre to say Mike Pence is one of the nicest guys, at least, you know, in a public setting, you know, with his chivalry, come out and say, name calling's got no place in politics.
Right.
And
it's
he said that.
Like, Mike, the call is coming from inside the House.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, to that particular incident, and literally at the same time, his running mate was name calling. He was, you know, was giving a speech using some of those pet nicknames that he has developed during the course of the campaign. And Jesse's right. We do have record high negatives on both candidates. I do think there's been a qualitative difference that I am one of those 18% that does have friends that are voting for Trump. And I have heard what I consider to be over the top conversations coming from both directions, but I do think there is has been a qualitative difference, and I do think that the juvenile, the name calling, has primarily come from one direction.
But I think let's say you and I are having dinner together, and I'm a Trump voter, and I would say, okay, Trump does do the schoolyard bully thing. It didn't work when Marco Rubio tried to kind of get in the dirt with him. Trump has sort of owned that. But hey, at your convention, Michael Bloomberg called him a con man. That's a name calling, isn't it?
It is. I think, though, there is a difference between the candidate whom we expect to be the leader. One of the things I always remember, I am the leader, if you will, of the entire town of Brighton. And we expect our president, as we said, we talked about the integrity of the office. We expect our president to be the president of all of the American people. We expect our president to love America, and it's disconcerting to hear the actual presidential candidate engaging in that. You know, traditionally, one of the things that parties have looked for in a vice presidential candidate is to be that junkyard dog, to do the things that it's been considered to be unseemly to do. And you're right, at some
and
level.
And maybe we should rework that model then, by the way,
well,
if that's the expectation.
And obviously, you know, Mr. Pence and
Tim Kaine, two of the nicest guys.
Neither one of them are
no.
Seem to be junkyard dog types.
They're terrible at it, yeah. If they even try.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I agree, though, with Bill. I mean, I've got plenty of friends and family who are voting Trump or voting Gary Johnson or yeah. Looking at Jill Stein or sort of undecided. You know, today you've got Matthew Dowd and Ron Fournier having a conversation online about whether we are seeing the end of a duopoly of party systems, which is probably a conversation for a separate program. But I think that is wired into the way people are feeling about politics. And then there I want to go back to what Jesse said about, you know, you kind of hinted at, you know, why we believe what we believe. And I want to play a clip from a guy who thinks we should be talking about hard things. His name is Peter Boghossian. His book is called A Manual for Creating Atheists. Now, if you just look at the title, you'd probably think he's really militant and he's always in your face about why you should be an atheist. And he's not. But he is the kind of guy who, in line at the bank, will turn to someone who's wearing a cross and say, hey, how's it going? I'd like to talk to you about something. Not aggressively. His view is aggression almost never works. But what works is at least asking people to examine not what they believe, but how they got there, why they believe what they believe, because that's when you start breaking down the components. Let's listen to him talking about, this is him talking to an online program called The Thinking Atheist, but it's his discussion about why, yes, he thinks we have to talk about it, whether it's abortion, politics, God, whatever. We have to talk about it. We should be allowed to state our beliefs, and we should be open to other evidence. And this is how he talks to people about God and atheism.
I almost never ever challenge or question the conclusion that somebody has. And a conclusion would be Jesus rose from a tomb, Muhammad flew, whatever the conclusion is. It's not about a conclusion, it's about the way people got there. So that's moral epistemology, how people come to moral knowledge, how they know what they think they know in the moral sphere. So people have built-in defensive mechanisms for conclusions, and they also have responses that they give, apologetics, things they've been trained in. But ways to come to knowledge have almost no defensive mechanisms. So that's the way to the belief. The way to the belief is through the process of knowing.
Eric Kane, what do you make of that?
Well, I'm listening to that, and I'm also thinking about the general question you've asked is, how come someone would want to have a political conversation? And, of course, I always come back to the notion of, well, I want them to agree with me. I want them to come to the same conclusion that I've come to. Now, I hear this fellow who's a very sophisticated way of trying to get people to sway people by asking him to look at the origins or the process by which, well, my
parents. Sure, the epistemology.
Yeah, my parents told me to say this, so I say this, but they didn't tell me in the direct way. It was sort of osmotic. You know, it just seeped in. And this always goes back to why there's blood on the floor, I guess, in Detroit or something, because, you know, people didn't agree. I always remember the conversation once I had with my father where I asked him for my advice, and he gave me advice, and then I got all angry with him because his advice didn't coincide with what I wanted to hear. So he finally turned to me and said, well, you know, did you want my advice or my approval? And I said, okay, that's the end of this. I understand what you're talking about. I was 21. I said, in the future, when I want your approval, I'll ask for it. Or when I want you to agree with me, I'll tell you, hey, I want you to agree with my political views or just your advice. And so I think that we're sort of stuck in the question of, is this a rational discussion that we're having? Or is this, you know, are you on my side? Are we in the same tribe? Are we in the same team? You know, do we wear the same color shirts when we go and cheer? And so, you know, you start to think of training camp has started for the Bills, you know, and people are rallying around and wearing blue and with a buffalo on it or something. And, you know, they get really hot and bothered about this. And, you know, sports isn't going to change the world. But in fact, there's, you know, tremendous, you know, we have soccer brawls, right? People are killed. I don't think it's very much different than politics at times.
But I think when I hear Boghossian talking about it, I think it makes sense to approach it from not just let's say Jesse and I are talking about whatever it is in politics, and I think what Jesse believes is silly. I don't think I'm going to change his mind if I really want to by saying, by the way, what you believe is silly. That's just going to be taken as sort of an ad hominem, and he's just going to sort of move on.
Yeah, it's an attack.
But if I said, let's talk about how you got there. Why do you believe this? Where did you read it? Okay, did you know X, Y, and Z? Or what's the source of information? Let's talk about it in a way that's not aggressive. Is that more effective?
Well, I think it may be more effective, but I'd go back to what's your motivation for trying to get him to change his opinion?
And actually, I think some of the studies these days are indicating that even that is not effective, and whether that's a function of how
people... It's got to be more effective than just saying you're an idiot.
Probably so. But I know there have been, you know, small group studies where people have been presented with worse and worse and worse information about Canada Day, and it only hardens.
Or vaccines, as Brandon Nyhan has
vaccines.
Studied.
Sure.
That's true.
Sure.
That's right. Okay. But I think what Eric is saying is, why are we even having the conversation? Because most of us would probably say, well, I want to know what they're thinking, and I'd like them to get on my side, right? And this is not me sort of chest beating or like patting myself in the back, but I love when my mind is changed. I really do.
Well,
I love when someone presents something and I go, wow, I never.
And out of 100 people, how many are like you?
Well, but I don't want to make it about me, and I don't want to make it pat yourself on the back.
In terms of the mindset.
But why? But let's pull it all the way back then. Why are we raising human beings to not be thrilled when new evidence changes their minds?
You're music to the ears of a researcher, and I spend a lot of time doing research, so I agree that, you know, saying that the data sway me in my thinking and that it challenge what I do is the core of much of my life. But on the other hand, that isn't necessarily shared by everyone. And it's clear that you can disagree and still have affection. I think that's the other side, which was sort of Jesse was alluding to. You know, we can talk, and not everybody storms out of the picnic, that there are people who really will disagree, but they care about each other enough, they listen enough, they're patient enough, and then they finally agree to disagree. And there are people who do that. And my brother and I have been politically different for our whole lives in some way, well, our adult lives. And he's a little right of center, I'm probably a little left of center, and we get along very well because we share common values.
But can you talk about it?
And we do. And we share common beliefs about outcomes, but we would get there in a different fashion. And so that's really part of the issue, which is, are people working from a common ground? Do they want to hear what the other person has to say, or are they really just in there to sway somebody to be like me.
Let me ask Bill and Jesse to kind of weigh in on that, because, again, these are two of the really nice human beings I know. But there must be times, Bill and Jesse, where you're talking to someone and you think, this is driving me crazy that they could actually think this way. And you've got to try to hold it in a civil fashion. Bill?
Well, sure. It does happen. And I think maybe, you know, we haven't talked about social media and the internet, but that has added a whole additional layer. And I think in addition to whatever unpopularity and frankly, there may be cause and effect there. But clearly, you know, these recent election cycles have been among the first where there has been just full on 24/7 internet, social media, and the anonymity that is often there fuels. And sometimes it's only perceived anonymity. You know, when you're looking someone eye to eye, you have a different conversation. You may know who it is on the other side of the computer screen who left that last comment, but you can still flame them in a way that you would never do on, you know, if you were talking face to face. So I think we, all of us, have to try to bring it back to, we can disagree. Eric made, a real good point of whether there's a common goal. And I think a lot of people, you know, on a lot of different topics may have common goal, you know, welfare reform. I don't think most people want to see people dying in debtors' prisons. They have different approaches to getting to a good economic position, to taking, you know, to getting people out of poverty.
That is a great
point.
They
just go at it differently.
I mean, Eric, do we ascribe inferior motives to people who disagree? I think welfare is a great example. I don't know anybody who loves seeing people in poverty suffering.
Well, think about your commentator a few moments ago who talked, you know, said he was an atheist and tried to get people to consider how they came to their religious beliefs. But let's think about religion in general, because politics and religion are very intertwined in the way people think about them. They're beyond just rational discussion. They're beliefs. They're belief systems. They're almost like creeds. And I think it's really important that we understand how much, at times, anger and fury we can see around the world when people clash around what to outsiders sound like relatively minor differences, but within the religions themselves, they may be battling intensely. I mean, we think of Christianity or Islam or in the Eastern religions where there have been wars on wars within the religious spheres. Yet to the outsider who's not practicing there, they say, well, you know, those are relatively minimal differences. So I think that we're in an area where it's very hard to get people to step back, to think more broadly, to think about the common areas, and to then say, well, how do we come to that political purpose? I mean, one of the wonderful things about the United States has been that throughout our history, for most of the time, we've been able to come to common cause around important things, whether it's economic development or development of the country or defending ourselves or you know, trying to have a democratic ideal where there's succession of presidents without having wars. But it's very difficult at times, and I think we're at one of those periods of times where we're at the low point of the cycle around how hostile people are to each other.
And go ahead, Jesse. I know you want to jump in.
Yeah, and I think I enjoy a good debate. You know, it's one of those things, whether it's my professional life, whether it's my personal life, if you have someone there who wants to engage on issues and talk about things of importance, that's something that you're going to absolutely take up the chance to be able to do that. And I would offer up the example of a frequent guest on your show, Dr. Jim Bowers, right? Dr. Jim was a professor of mine when I was at Fisher, and he is about as far from my political perspective as one could possibly be. And Jim and I have had heated arguments going back to my time as a student with him through today, and we remain close friends. But the one thing I will say, though, is that I don't want it to make it sound like that believing strongly is a bad thing, or that having a principle that you stick to is a bad thing, because I think the supervisor would admit this. To work in this sphere, to work in this environment every day, you have to feel strongly about what we do. You have to have some sort of ground rock position, a set of beliefs from which you operate. That doesn't mean that you can't be open to other evidence or that you shouldn't seek out other evidence to, you know, potentially be a fully informed citizen or a elected official or wherever it may be on these things. But the one thing we say in our office all the time is that I would rather deal with a citizen who contacts us passionately about something that means something to them, no matter what the position is, no matter what background they're coming from. I would rather deal with that neighbor than deal with the neighbor who really doesn't feel strongly about anything, or maybe, you know, may see these very important things go on, but decides this process is bigger than me. I can never change anything, so I'm not going to get involved. That passionate person, that's the one who's going to end up making a difference. I mean, no matter what level of government or politics you are at, if enough people contact you with a certain concern or a certain point of view, you will take notice of that. It's human nature. There's no way you can't. So you want those people who feel passionately, and you want them to reach out. And I think the one piece that we keep coming back to in the hour is, how do you do that in a way that's respectful and respects the person on the other side of the table?
I might provide a sort of a different perspective from medicine. Because in medicine, you know, the passion is you want to make a difference in someone's life. You want to do it in a way which will help heal or treat someone, even if you can't heal them, in such a way that you reduce suffering. Over and over and over again, new knowledge comes, and you have to give up on the old data. You have to accept that the findings, that maybe you were doing it the wrong way, and we've advanced our learning. And
yes.
One of the things that's
open to evidence.
Open to evidence. And one of the things
exactly.
that's clear is that the passion shouldn't go away. Passion shouldn't block your ability to reason. And so one of the things I think we're talking about is, how can you have values? How can you be passionate? How can you promote those? But how can you then also look in front of you, whether it's the results of economic policy or social policy, and say, is it really making a difference in our country and people's lives? And that's where it's become very hard, because there's almost, I think, at times, such ideology that people are holding on to at a belief level, and I don't mean a belief level based on anything but sort of rigidity, that they don't want to let go of their belief even in the face of data that might say otherwise.
And sometimes we hear the term steadfast in their beliefs. There's a difference between being steadfast in your beliefs and being obstinate and refusing to
or
accept
closed-minded.
Evidence. Closed-minded. Epistemic closure is a great disease, but I'm way late for a break. Let's do this. I want to get to your phone calls. Tim, Bill, others who've been waiting to weigh in. We're going to get you after the only break of the hour, and we'll continue the discussion. I'm struck by what Jesse said. You and Jim Bowers, you disagree on almost everything, but you probably love that man, and I know he feels the same about you, because you probably do not ascribe any evil or nefarious motives to him.
Right.
You both want a great country. You both want freedom and opportunity for people. You want success for people. You view very different ways to get there, as opposed to thinking, well, he disagrees. He must not care about people. He
right.
must not care about children. He must not care. You know, and that's what that's why I think sparks all the anger, is that, you know, they must be indifferent to suffering. So let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back with your phone calls with Jesse Sleaser, Communications and District Director for Senator Rich Funke, Bill Maley, Supervisor of the Town of Brighton, and Eric Kane, Chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Coming up in our second hour, we preview the 2016 Puerto Rican Festival, which is this weekend in Rochester. We'll talk food, culture, games, activities for family, and more. And we'll talk about how the organizers of the festival are working with the Rochester Police Department to try to make sure everything stays orderly after the festival is over. That's coming up next hour on Connections. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. To your phone calls we go, and Tim in Pittsford is first. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan. I think one of the issues that I've dealt with is, I have a job that I can listen to the radio all day, and I do, and I listen to politics all day, which is nuts, but I listen to both sides. But most people don't do that. Most people get up, go to work. I know there's more ways to reach people now through social media, but they get home, eat dinner, and if they're lucky, or if the news stations are lucky, 1 in 10 people are watching the news at night. And so if you start to get, I found myself getting into political arguments, and it's just normal people that aren't getting all the information I'm getting. That's not making me right or wrong, but I'm arguing with them, thinking that, you know, they get to listen to the radio all day, watch the news, all this stuff. And it's just not how normal people or normal Americans are. They're getting little pieces here and there. And, you know, if you try and go too far with them, it's going to upset them, and they're going to get defensive. And you're right when you say
you're really more than likely you're not going to change anyone's mind. They have their own values and thoughts about things, and they are going to get defensive. The only time I think I've ever had an effect on someone as far as possibly changing their mind or getting someone to think about something is when I brought up gay marriage. And I said, in all honesty, after all this arguing, how do two guys getting married affect your life or your marriage? And the person sat there and didn't say anything. And that is probably the only argument. I who knows what they think about it now, but they actually thought about it. So that's what I think. Thanks, Evan.
Tim, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate that. I mean, I don't disagree that most people are not likely to change their mind. It's also why I like to open conversations with, are you willing to change your mind? Or what would it take to change your mind? And I jump in to say, my mind is open to change. You can absolutely change my mind with evidence. Let's have a conversation. If the answer is nothing, then it is a waste of time, isn't it, Eric?
I mean, and I think they're both the caller, Tim, and you are both talking about how much you really willing to listen to someone else.
Yeah.
How much you're willing to focus on what that person has to say, as opposed to just replaying your own thoughts aloud to them, running the script out and saying, well, you know, you really need to hear what I have to say. And this goes back to, you know, are they going to be like me? Are they going to be on my team? Or are they going to, or can I actually allow myself to give up my thought or my idea in preference to theirs? So there's a losing quality that some people may feel, and it's hard to lose, even if someone else is right. You know, think of the arguments we've all had in life in one way or another where, you know, we just want to win the argument even if it isn't really about much.
But it's disarming to say I was wrong, because people, I find when I'm arguing or debating with someone and I can back up and say, you know what, you're right, I was wrong, that disarms them because they have no expectation that that's even possible. It's almost like people expect that it's just... just sort of lobbing rhetorical bombs with no outcome that could change. And when that happens, I think that opens the door to maybe opening in their mind.
Yeah, and actually, the caller's example of same-sex marriage is a good one, because it gets back to something we were talking about earlier. It's not just about the argument. It's about something underlying. And in that case, it was the underlying happiness of those two people and how it would affect this person's underlying happiness. And it sounds like someone was willing to listen and say, you know what, that's going to make someone's life, I hadn't thought of it that way, it's going to make someone's life better, it's not going to hurt my life, that's okay. That's a good thing.
I like this email I got from a listener named Andrew. I'll read that and then we'll come back to your phone calls. Andrew writes, so my brother and I are usually are on opposite ends of the political spectrum. Years ago, we used to yell at each other. That proved to be pointless. Then we used that stupid phrase, agree to disagree, which in my mind just underlines that we both think the other person is wrong. Now we accept that we have different ideas on how to achieve a better society. The political relationship between us has improved as a result of this acceptance. The personal relationship has always been positive and will continue to be that way. For me personally, I like it that there are people who think differently than I do. It would be a very strange and perhaps boring world if everyone thought exactly the way I do. That's from Andrew. I like that perspective, Andrew. Yeah. Thank you for that. And it's nice to hear that that's been an effective way for you guys to approach that relationship. Let me get back to your phone calls. And this is Eric in Rochester. Next up. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi. I used to work for a company that taught group problem-solving techniques. And the mantra that we used, which I found very useful, is if I really listen to you, the danger is I might have to change.
Yes, that's right. It's
and
true.
It was very useful for people in group problem solving. And that's all.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's actually a great mantra to think of, too. Jesse, go ahead.
I think we've all encountered these situations where it feels like folks are unable or unwilling to change their minds. And I'm actually going to go a little bit against that grain. And I think if you observe data, right, voters actually change their minds all the time, mm-hmm. right? I think it's tough to sometimes think of these things as if every voter is a monolith, and we break them up into monolith groups, and we separate them based on where 48% of the country will go and the other 48% of the country will go, and we stack them up across on the checkerboard across from each other, and we go to battle. I think sometimes, you know, when you're dealing with someone, if they may have a very high partisan intensity, will they be less likely to change their mind? Probably. But there's a whole continuum of people and voters and types of communities in between there that don't line up into those neatly accepted groups. And honestly, that's how you see elected officials be elected, but that yet later defeated. That's how you see polling change. I mean, up as recently as a week ago, Nate Silver, right, who tends to operate on a pretty accurate and fact-based analysis, predicted that Trump was going to win the nomination. His model showed a Trump win.
If the election was being held that day.
It's a snapshot in time. And since then, a week later, it now shows that Mrs. Clinton would win. So I think that speaks to the fact that we don't necessarily see a hardening in all people that we might suspect. I think some people are pre-inclined based on how strongly they feel and how strongly passionate they are about their partisan values, that partisan intensity. They're pre-inclined to probably not change their mind a lot. But not every voter's like that.
Right. And I think presidential elections, just because of their binary nature, I mean, we do have a two-party system, albeit with other minor parties, but people come to their choices from different reasons and are a lot more willing, I think, to change their minds about different individual areas. But you can't get away from the fact that when you have that binary choice of a presidential election, we think of the two great landslide elections in the, at least Eric's in my memory, the Goldwater race and the Dukakis race. Both of those candidates who were seen as being absolutely trounced got more than 40% of the vote. So 4 out of 10 plus people, when it seemed like that they were just out of it, supported them. So it's an interesting dichotomy. And there on that binary choice, am I going to vote for the Democrat or the Republican on the Tuesday in November? It does seem like both parties have, you know, a base, a core of people who absolutely will come hell or high water. They may change their mind and do change their mind. And that is a great thing on all sorts of things in their life and in individual issues. But when they go into the ballot box, they vote.
So Jesse's talking about something and you're talking about something, which I think is actually a play in this election that we have to be mindful of, which is, yeah, effective candidates can change people's minds. We see it all the time. But this then starts to get to the issues of leadership and participatory leadership and all sorts of things. And these are candidates who in their various ways are leadership challenged. Mr. Trump hasn't identified himself as leadership challenged, but others have. Mrs. Clinton has said, public service is my thing and the public part is hard for me to come by compared to the service part, which is a way of saying, you know, being a leader out there is sometimes difficult for me. And so when you have leadership challenged people in the context of the polarization that we also see, then some of the rules or some of the opportunities for developing consensus are harder to come by. And we're really seeing, I think, in this election, a difficulty developing consensus, which is in some sense compromise. And again, this is not a compromise situation, but compromise again means losing some of or letting go of some of what you hold dear because you want to have a relationship with the other person to get something done. And that's become very difficult in American politics over the last 20 years. So they're punctuation marks as much as they are the event themselves.
All right, we're talking about how to discuss politics without losing our relationships with those around us in this heated election cycle, and got a lot of phone calls. We'll try to move quickly for the remainder of the hour. Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
It's so funny because this is an interesting conversation because it's actually dear to my heart. I've actually run into that problem of literally my opinion about political things have caused the schism and some family relationships. Just because of my relationship with the person, which it just totally blew my mind. And it's something, it's a hard, right now I'm trying to work through it, but it's amazing how binary, like you say, everything seems to be. Either you are a sexist or you're not. Either you're a racist or you're not. There's no nuance in people's views. They take some really, really hard-edged views. And even when you try to be nuanced and you try to explain things, people don't want to hear it. Everybody seems to hear exactly what they want to hear, and then they quickly label you based on the fact that you disagree with them. And it's brutal out here right now. But just one thing I have to touch on. When one gentleman mentioned Nate Silver, and I look at his thing every single day. Trump was never predicted to win. He was predicted to – he was closer.
Silver has said he got Trump wrong. He's had a very good record, but he's got – Silver has said he has a very good record in electoral politics, but he's gotten Trump wrong really throughout this cycle, and he's written pretty extensively about that.
Yeah. So I just don't know what the answer is going to be. I think it's a lot of this is based on the change of Barack Obama going into the White House and the really, really extreme reaction just with him being elected president. And a lot of that wasn't about politics. And now everybody seems to be glomming on. Even on the Republican side, the born-again Christians are going for a man who's less religious than Hillary Clinton. So you wonder, they always say it's about their religion, but it's not. It's just crazy. I look out here and just people's reactions are really bad.
All right, well, Rich, thanks for the call. I mean, I don't want to get down in the weeds on each individual issue, but let me just ask Eric Kane, who's the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Rich says it feels really crazy out here. And to me, that brings to mind the people in social media. We've seen people on Facebook say, get ready to get unfriended if I see you post it. We've all seen that, right? I mean, Jesse, you're nodding right away. We've seen it. Is that healthy to take that disposition that says, I'm not going to deal with it. If you're X and X supporter, you know, we're done. Is that healthy?
Well, you know the answer as you asked the question.
I actually don't know that it's definitely not. I just feel like that can't be the right way to
go. Well, one of the things that's really striking is, the caller Rich or others are saying, it's more important to express my point of view than it is to have our relationship. I'd rather sacrifice our relationship and tell you exactly what I think over and over and over again, or as explicitly as possible. The other side of it, of course, is people are saying, I want a test. Here's the test. If you disagree with me on the following things, I'm dumping you. So it's sort of bidirectional. And it's really a sad thing. When you see that, you know, healthy. I wouldn't call that ever a good way to build a relationship, but it's very clear how sad it is that people are losing ties, or losing what they held dear, because they quote failed the test, that someone else set up for them, or they fail somebody's. They say you failed. I'm not. And that we've come to that point is. At such a big level. Now, we've always had extremes in our society, right? We've always had people who are at the far extreme who will fail others or blacklist others or blackball others or call them, a racist or, discriminatory. But it feels like that's moved more and more to the central tendency, and I think that's what's so worrisome.
All right, Dave in Rochester, about 20 seconds. Go ahead, Dave.
I just have a general comment, and then I'll take your answer off the air. I think Evan said sometimes you start discussions by saying, can you possibly change your mind?
Right.
Well, doesn't that presume that you're engaging in a debate? I mean, if you are simply having a discussion and you want to hear somebody else's point of view,
why does
it matter whether the other person can change his mind or not?
It's a fair question. I would just answer that to say there are different purposes for different conversations. I mean, there are certainly different times where I just want to listen. And there are times where I think, all right, let's joust on this, but only if you're willing to change, because I am. I don't want to invest any emotional energy in a conversation if I'm willing to change my mind and the other person is not. So some final quick comments here. Jesse and Bill, go ahead. What would you leave the audience with?
Yeah, there's one thing that I don't want to get lost in today's entire discussion is that it's clear that some people do feel very passionately about this election, the presidential election, what's at stake for the country. And honestly, that's a good thing. I think to discount that, there is an anger right now in the electorate, and we've seen it on both sides of the aisle. We've seen it in polling. You see it anecdotally. You discount that as at your peril, to be honest with you, because there is definitely a number of folks out there who feel very disenfranchised, who feel very angry with the status quo. And so I think the central, the nexus of the election, the question of the election is going to be, do you feel confident in the direction of the country, or do you not feel confident in the direction of the country? And so the question comes down to, you know, depending on the candidate, who do you generally line up behind? And the difference is, though, that even with that anger, you need to be able to maintain that open mind. I'm sorry, I kind of took the time, but I went to the supervisor.
That's okay. Bill probably agrees with just about everything you just said there. 20 seconds, Bill, go.
Well, all I was going to say is, you know, there are so many issues. I wrote about something in the DNC not long ago after some of the shootings, and I think it's important that we try to remember we are neighbors. We need to have these discussions, but we need to do them in a way that is civil, that allows us to maintain those relationships, feel passionately, but get on with our lives.
All right, and listeners, I've said it before, I'm going to say it again. If you haven't read the New Yorker piece called Unfollow about Megan Phelps Roper and changing the mind of someone from the Westboro Baptist Church, you think no one will ever change their mind? Read Unfollow tonight. Thanks for a great discussion to our entire panel. More Connections next.
Thanks, Evan.